Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
So my next interview was a real treat. I was able to have a long and a substantive and intimate conversation with Mark Pellegrino. You know him in other capacities probably than somebody who would call themselves radically consistent or an objectivist or somebody who might be talking about metaphysics or epistemology. He's an actor, and he's been in pretty much everything. You really need to look up Mark's IMDb profile. His filmography is quite remarkable. It's deep. It's wide. You probably know him for Supernatural or maybe Lost, maybe 13 Reasons Why. Being Human. How about The Big Lebowski? I mean, the list is pretty endless. But we believe it or not, we did talk a little bit about Mark's acting. We talked about how he stepped into it and how he kind of, you know, in his words, won the lottery and where he came from and where he's heading. And we talked about self-assertion and collaboration and how he has this sort of systemic approach to his art and how he looks in scripts for human moments, which I think is really quite a delightful notion, and I mean applicable to pretty much everything we do. It's applicable to who we are as humans and our families and the communities we work in, the schools we attend and the places we go, the dance floors we dance on. We talked about choice and about context. We talk about capitalism and about the misinformation around it. We talk about the two-party systems, system and the issues with that. What does it actually mean to be radically consistent? And how Mark talks a great deal about how ethics is linked to human thriving. We talk about living, we talk about life, the notion of volition and intellectual curiosity. Am I getting your is your level of interest being raised here? I sure hope so. Please stay tuned for a conversation about pretty much everything. I can't wait for part two with Mark. I'm looking forward to it very much. And if you want to find out more about the work that I do, davidpecklive.com, you can do that there. Find out more about my speaking and my writing. And don't forget, if you want to support the work I'm doing on Face to Face, you can do that through patreon.com and get behind me financially in what we're doing here at Face to Face. And if you can't do that, and I totally get that, a review or a quote or something out there somewhere would be great. Follow us on social, share us with your friends. If you want to advertise on the podcast, please do reach out as well. And don't forget, another platform I'm on, rabble.ca, lots of other writers, thinkers, journalists, podcasters, people you want to be listening to, people you want to be thinking about and reading. Don't forget to head there as well. Coming right up, Mark Pellegrino.
Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest with us here today. An interview I've really been looking forward to. Mark Pellegrino is with us today here on Face to Face to talk about, not exactly sure where we're going to go, but let's get this out of the gate. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
So where do we start? Do we start with Hollywood? Do we start with the screenplay and the story? Do we start with individualism? What when where would you start, Mark? Maybe is a good question. You've been in. I can't believe, by the way, your CV, your IMDb CV is just, it's remarkable, the stuff that you've been in and the people you've worked alongside. Maybe you can kind of set my guests up with a little bit of context. And then, of course, we're going to talk a bit about the American Capitalist Party for sure.
Cool. Okay. Maybe my IMDb page will shift the more Hollywood starts to learn that I'm an individualist. But that remains to be seen. I got into acting in the late 80s, 87. I was in my early 20s, sort of stumbled into it by chance and started working before I even knew what the craft of acting was.
Right.
Again, seemingly by chance, I'm not one who believes in that type of stuff, but it would appear to apply to parts of my life. I started studying with a theater company called Playhouse West in Studio City, and that became sort of my my technique home. And it was based on the Sanford Meisner technique. And Sanford Meisner, when he was transitioning from New York to Los Angeles, and Beckley to Los Angeles, actually used our school as a sort of transition stage and taught classes there for a while, and I was fortunate enough to sit in on those classes, and that introduced me to craft and made me fall in love with it. And then I started, you know, going through that long, arduous journey of learning to apply the classroom antics to actual life, and there was it's quite a difficult transition doing that, mainly in, you know, just standing up and asserting yourself in a collaborative effort wherein right. the actor is usually the last piece of the puzzle to be the creative puzzle. That sort of self-assertion sort of came with age and doing the wrong things and and compromising enough so that it became intolerable to compromise.
I think one of the sound bites already is for me is self assertion came with age. It's lovely. I love it. It's a great opening line for something.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I think you start with time. The good thing about aging is that you sort of burn off whatever false beliefs you held and whatever ideas you held about how you should be esteemed by your fellow man. It becomes more important to self-actualize and realize your potential than you know, to be concerned about what other people think about what you're doing. And that comes with time. Some people are fortunate enough to have that from the get-go, and some have to learn it, as I've had to learn and am still learning.
So many places I want to dive in there, and we're you know what, I'm going to say this right out of the gate that we're barely going to scratch the surface. I can sense that already as we just start down this road. Tell me a little bit more about you know, you said introduced you to craft. What do you mean by that? Is that technique? Is that a way about stepping into a character? Is it about self-assertion?
It is yes, all of the above. In my opinion, I'm sure different actors would have different responses to what craft is. But to me, craft is an overall systematic approach to your art, and one that involves as much conscientiousness and awareness in the process as possible. And that isn't self-evident to a lot of people. Some, you know, we're actors. We run in a world where good acting looks so effortless that it appears to the person watching that it requires nothing of it.
Right. What's so hard about that, Mark? I mean, come on.
Right. And so I think people come to Hollywood with the notion that all I got to do is just get up there and maybe be myself, and you know. All the dominoes will fall the way I intend them to. And that's, you know, being yourself is even a trick that requires craft and a great deal of work. And so for me, it was about finding a systematic approach to breaking down a script and a systematic approach to applying the discoveries that I've made in the script to an actual human moment. And in the end, learning to leave myself alone so that the human moment can actually happen between me and the other actor.
Is there a sense in which you, and I love all the metaphors we're touching on here, but and I think of some of your CV as well, and I'm going to definitely in my pre-intro sort of let our listeners know if they don't already, if they're not a fan and so on and don't know your background. Some of the stuff that you've worked in, it seems to me, is can I say profoundly meaningful? I mean, deep scripts, spiritual scripts, a lot of substance there. And I mean, I don't know if that was by choice or if that's just kind of how it fell into place over time. And Kierkegaard said, we step into it, but we only understand, step into the future, we only understand when we look back. But I wonder, I love what you just said about discovering in a script this human moment. I wonder if you've actually chosen to do that over the years. Is that a fair question?
I mean, it is. I think a lot of people can be quite conscious and directed in the projects that they choose. And I think the more established you become, the easier it is to do that.
Right.
I mean, for me, a great portion of at least half of my career was just about, putting bread and onions on the table
right.
and doing the best I could with whatever I had. And later on, it became more about choice. I don't want to say the purest sense of the word, because
right.
I mean you're always making the choices. But sometimes it's between: do I take this job that I don't necessarily like, or doesn't communicate the best values in the world, or the character's a little superficial, or do I put food on the table and keep the lights on? When you don't have that. Blaring simple issue of survival staring you in the face, you can be a little bit more circumspect about what you take and what you don't. I still think to some degree it's been somewhat accidental that if I've done anything with significant meaning, that it's if it hasn't been produced by me, it's been more or less a bit of a winning the lottery,
right.
for lack of a better term.
I the whole notion of, and I'm sure, if we had a screenwriter or a screenwriter or an author on the line, this idea of authorial intention, they'd have probably something to say about that. But again, you look back and I mean, you're the only one who had anything to do with it, as far as I'm concerned. Do you know what I mean? Like,
sure.
you're the one who said yes to this and no to that. And it was for, this is what a confluence of events is all about, it seems to me. This is what, Splash and Ripple is all about. When you look back, it kind of starts to make some sense.
That's true. Unfortunately, I don't think, and once again, this is different for everyone, but I don't think you necessarily have a rational grasp on how to choose
right.
Early on in life. I don't think you have the proper context and you just simply don't know enough or you're overcome with, some kind of prejudice or emotion
right.
that pulls you away from the right thing to do, and it takes a great deal of context building to get to the point where you can sort of set all those objects up and knock them down in the right order.
It, only with age, as you said earlier, you to your point, you burn off those false beliefs.
Yes. Yes.
So are you, co-founder of the American Capitalist Party, you say that Hollywood is going to maybe turn their back on you? Is that
I keep anticipating that.
Right.
A lot of podcasts that I do, and many of the hosts wonder if I have experienced any backlash from my political beliefs. So far that I know of, I haven't. But I think that's mainly because, as a capitalist, there's a lot of misinformation and presumptions floating around about capitalism, but you tend, as a capitalist, you tend to fall into a political camp that is unfamiliar to both sides of our, you're in Canada, so of our political spectrum.
Sure.
Which is basically a two-party system, left and right, that they think they've got some big differences when they actually don't. And so you end up falling in between the cracks and become, in the minds of most people, sort of an undefinable entity, you know.
Right.
And I think that sort of saves me, because I think my left-leaning friends in Hollywood could definitely point to many of the things that I hold to be true. And so, well, those are quote-unquote liberal, left liberal ideas. And some of my conservative friends, which are far fewer in Hollywood, can point to some of my my beliefs and say, oh, those seem to be conservative beliefs. So they don't quite know how to classify me. And I think that saves me a little bit of trouble.
Right, right. And has this sort of, I mean, obviously it's developed over time, I suppose, but was there a point in your life that you can look back and say, you know, this was the shift, this, you know, it was reading Ayn Rand, it was The Fountainhead, it was a class that you took, a film, you know, one of those, what would you call them, epiphantic moments?
Yeah, you know, I had a book exchange with a fellow actor friend of mine in my theater company, and we made an agreement to exchange 5 books with each other that, that were important. And he gave me only 2. He gave me The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged.
Oh, wow.
And
it's a lot of reading.
It was a lot of reading. My fare was a lot lighter, like M. Scott Peck's The Road Less Traveled.
Nice.
Richard Bach's Illusions, and I think Dan Millman's Way of the Peaceful Warrior. I don't remember what the other 2 were, but they were somewhere in that. Maybe Fear and Trembling or something, you know, things
nice.
Like that. good reads, but I don't, and substantial in Fear and Trembling, I think, would be more substantial than all of them. But
maybe Mark, was the 5th one a copy of the most recent Mad magazine? Was that on the table?
That should have been on the table.
It should have been on the table. Yeah.
That was my preferred reading in the 70s. I remember reading The Fountainhead, the end of The Fountainhead, on a bus in the valley here in California. And I took the bus all the way to the end of the line, which ended at this massive boulevard and a huge grass island that separated 2 sides of the boulevard. And I just walked out to this grass island and collapsed in tears.
Wow. That's
the tears weren't necessarily the tears of an epiphany. They were sort of a negative epiphany.
Okay.
In reading this fantastic book about egoism and about the artist's integrity and the integrity of the ego and self-interest, I found so much of my inner life resonating with Peter Keating, one of the villains, the second hander of the story, sort of the tool of the main villain of the story. And I found myself, I didn't know, and I also found elements of my personality that were very much like Howard Rourke, the hero of the story. I didn't know how to bridge the gap between the two. And no solution was offered in the book. But it sent me on an odyssey of sorts, where I pretty much read everything that Rand wrote, and really became immersed in it and accepted much of her ideas, but intellectually. I don't know that they had filtered down into my subconscious until probably the last few years,
right,
to be honest with you.
Right. Well, and this is, I think this, I mean, to me, this sort of connects with your point earlier about the whole way. I mean, I'd like to think with age comes wisdom, but I'm not sure that's necessarily true. But over time in your experiences, you start to indwell it in a way, don't you?
Yeah, I remember a story, Leonard Peikoff. I don't know if you're familiar with Leonard.
No.
He's the intellectual heir for Ayn Rand, and he's a philosophy professor. He's taught all over the world. And he was talking about a concept and how it can finally resonate with you. And
Mark, you're not going to believe me, but I actually listen. Older man, right? Late 80s, probably mid 80s.
Yeah, I
do know the name. As soon as you said it, I went, actually, I do know that. Yeah, I heard a podcast recently from him not that long ago. How odd is that? Anyway, go ahead.
Wow. Yeah, he sort of retired. He actually did a radio show back in the early 90s. It was phenomenal. It was becoming syndicated in about a year because his show was so unusual and so deep. But he was getting older, and just he felt that the time to prepare the show was just inordinate, and he couldn't take all the stresses and strains. He had to drop out. But anyway, one day he was writing a concept or a proposition on the chalkboard, and he looked at it. He'd been writing that proposition for probably 20 years, and he looked at it and he said, "That is right." And so he had that internal movement in him where whatever that proposition was, it actually became true to him in more than just the intellectual sense. And right. I feel like that's been happening with me with respecting objectivism only over the last few years.
How would you – so I'm guessing that some of my listeners will have read Rand and some will have not. Remarkable that her book still sells so well. I think I read just as I was prepping about 100,000 copies a year of The Fountainhead still are selling. I mean, that's pretty significant for somebody who was a best-selling author back in the 50s. Can you kind of unpack objectivism in a couple of – I mean, you call yourself a radical capitalist too, right?
I do.
Right. Which I love, by the way. I love that phrase. I don't think I've ever heard that quite. I would say raging free market capitalist, maybe. That might be my phrase.
I would say radical only in this sense. Radical for me is synonymous with consistent. So there's there's no point at which I think individual rights should be violated.
Right.
So nowadays, in a world of mixed economies, where socialism and sort of some elements of free market exist sort of in combination with each other, I have to make that distinction, you know, because people associate our corporatist system today with a kind of capitalism, and it's not, it's a corporatist system. It's a mixed economy. It's some state controls and some free market, but in essence, the government has all the say over how one disposes one's property, and so I have to delineate myself from sort of the current atmosphere and call myself by a name that sort of might give some people the heebie-jeebies. You know, radical is sort of a a scary thing to call yourself.
Oh, sure. People. Yeah, no, I love this. I love the idea. The idea of being consistent and radical make a lot of sense to me. So you would say then was it Chesterton or Churchill, somebody like that, who said the free market has never been really, has never really been tried before, right?
That is correct.
Yeah.
I think we came close to it, you know, in about 120 or 30 year span from the founding of our country up until about the mid-1800s or late 1800s.
So, yeah. So could you unpack this idea of objectivism for a quick philosophical lecture for us from the front? You've got the lectern and the whiteboard. It's all yours.
That is massively intimidating. That is intimidating as a white, a blank page for a writer.
I bet.
Especially something as vast as a philosophical system.
It's pretty huge. It's a pretty ridiculous question. It's like saying, what's your, you know, give us your life history in 32 and a half seconds or less. I mean, it's absurd.
You're right. Well, so I'll just stick to sort of three aspects of philosophy,
sure.
metaphysics, epistemology, and ethics. And so I'll just say
just the three easy ones.
You're right. We're going down this rabbit hole, I guess.
That's right. Yeah.
So for metaphysics, existence exists. For epistemology, reason is your means of perceiving and integrating the facts of existence. And ethics is rational egoism or rational self-interest. So that's a real thumbnail sketch of objectivism.
So metaphysically we exist, therefore we kind of are, and that's all we got. It's not in the head, it's not out there, it's present, it's right now, and then we get there through reason. So we know by and through reason, and I guess largely empirical, I would say, I guess. And then
largely empirical, but it doesn't rationalize concepts away. So concepts are our means of understanding reality.
Right.
It's a primacy of existence orientation.
Right.
Towards human consciousness.
And then, can you unpack the ethics for me a little bit more? So this idea of sort of again rational egoism or individualism. It sort of sounds almost contradictory to the notion of ethics in some ways.
Well, I think, and that's where objectivism is unique in the field of ethics, because ethics is linked to human thriving and life. Ethics is more or less a guide, a conceptual guide for life. That's what virtues are. Virtues are actions that we take for the betterment of our lives, in the pursuit of our interests and happiness. And so rather than detaching ethics from human want, human needs, and even making ethics contrary to human life, objectivism blended the two of them together and said, well, ethics is about living. They're a guide for life, because a human consciousness is non-automatic. A rational consciousness is volitional. It can turn on or off. People can't quite understand the notion of volition, and they don't understand that it's a cause. It's sort of an axiomatic concept. It's its own cause, and because of that, we can or can't. We should or shouldn't. We could or couldn't or don't have to apply our mind to the problem of existence. We need a guide. We have no automatic knowledge. We have no instantaneous sense for what's right or wrong. We need to know things and learn these things, and that's what morality provides us with. That.
And by volition, you would say choice or intention. Is that a fair?
I would say volition into an objectivist is the choice to focus or not, the choice to think or not.
Right.
Not even necessarily about the concretes between do I want chocolate ice cream or vanilla ice cream. Yeah.
And now are we sort of back to being radically consistent now?
I hope so.
Yeah, no, I mean it sounds like kind of a perfect link to me. Love to hear a little bit more about your party, the political party, your co-founder of it. But I want to just ask you a little bit more about some of the work you've done as an artist and an actor. I mean, imagination, thought, creativity. Does it make sense to you that you've sort of gone down this political, ethical, and philosophical road with the work that you've been doing for so many years, working in that world of imagination, I guess?
I think it does, because I think, the primary work of an actor is self-exploration.
Right.
You bring yourself to everything that you do, and you want to bring the deepest, most full understanding of life and human circumstances that you can bring to bear on any situation that you're confronting in your acting world. So it inspires, it should inspire intellectual curiosity. And every role that you do should also inspire intellectual curiosity, and it's, you're sort of compelled by virtue of the desire to fulfill the part, to travel down roads you might not ordinarily travel down, and that requires a lot of study. you know? So yeah, I think that my philosophical evolution and then expressing that evolution in the form of a political party has all sort of been grist for the artistic mill. You know, it's all been part of the process of growing and learning and being as endlessly curious as I think a striving potential artist as like myself should be.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to talk about human flourishing and about maybe the greatest good, and I don't necessarily mean that from a utilitarian point of view, but you need to talk about those spaces. There's a deep need for the arts. Isn't this what creativity is really all about? How do we provide a space for our kids and our communities and our families and friends to actually be able to do that? And that's kind of what you're talking about, isn't it?
It is, and I think narratives are great learning tools. Mm. There's a reason Rand wrote Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged right before she wrote Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology. I mean, the philosophy embodied in human action. That's what we are seeing when we read her books. The potential on both sides for great human evil and great human good are both illustrated in very clear terms in books like that. And I think that's the ultimate goal that any writer should have, or any artist should have, is to either reflect something beautiful or to take down something ugly, you know. And
nice.
I think good artists are sort of the barometer of the culture, but they're also independent thinkers. And I don't see a lot of that in our culture today. I see great actors who hold on to bromides like there's no tomorrow, and are able to apply great creativity to their work, but not to their ethics or politics or social outlook, and will strive for great liberty and freedom in their work, but extol policies that do quite the opposite. So, restrain people.
Walking contradictions.
And that's another thing that I love about Rand, is that her system of thought is about integrating knowledge in a non-contradictory way. And if you find contradictions in what you're thinking, you have to suss that out. You have to weed out that contradiction by finding what's so. Something is false. We'll find what's false and get it out of there.
So in other words, and reason will get us there. So thinking about this, working through this, testing it. This is what the laboratory is for. This is what debate is about. It's about getting to a better place, right?
Agreed. Yeah. I mean, when we're talking about principles of ethics, though, it's not like you can put it in a laboratory
right
and test it. Unfortunately,
right,
when we feel a lot easier. When we end with sort of axiomatic concepts, it's just you see it or you don't. Where do we go?
So you know what's so fascinating to me, Mark, is I love the paradox of this sort of this individualism alongside of creativity that's actually going to lead us to this notion of human flourishing, which I guess ironically is really ultimately going to benefit the other as well, right?
It will.
Yeah, because the idea. So I come from a lot of the work that I've done over the last 20 years has been in development, and it's about empowering communities and so on. But I mean, many of the people that I'm rubbing shoulders with would come out against somebody like you, and this is I guess why you're saying maybe you're going to not be invited to as many cocktail parties over the next few years as you dig deeper. But it does strike me as a little bit of a contradiction. Maybe paradox is a better word.
I think once again they've assumed right and morals have to do with a negation of the self.
Right.
And nothing could be further from the truth. And that's a hard sell. I mean, altruistic spins on ethics have been culturally dominant for a couple of thousand years. And and selling someone on the, you know, just merely on the idea that, you know, ethics is about the pursuit of the good in your life, in your own life, and that the purpose of moral code is human thriving and happiness, not self-sacrifice, denial, negation, or death even, you know, or sacrifice. It's actually about gain and good and health, and the more you do those things rationally, the better it is for you. It so happens that we live in a trader society, more or less. I mean, the trader society is one built on mutual gain, where each person goes for their self-interest, but they understand that we live in a society of right and liberty, and we can only exchange with another human being as an equal. And that's what is the prescription for a trade. Two people equals, who are legal equals, coming together to benefit from some exchange between each other on their own terms. There may be compromises in those terms that they have to make with each other, but, you know, in the end, both win, as opposed to the zero-sum game of altruism.
Does this work? Do you think this works in I'm just going to read this here. We uphold the principle of individual rights, quote, our philosophy of life permeates our political principles. We stand for reason, for individual rights, for limited constitutional government, and for laissez-faire capitalism, close quote. That's right off of the American Capitalist Party's website, by the way, folks. That's theamericancapitalistparty.com. Does that work? Does that work globally? Is that going to work in Malawi? Is that going to work in Mongolia? Or is this, would you say, more of a, you know, sort of Western philosophical kind of position to take?
It's an interesting question. Let me just turn it around on you.
Yeah, go.
Will reason and liberty work anywhere?
Mm.
To me, those are universally applicable principles.
Well, and the short answer seems to be yes, right?
Of course.
Yeah.
Now, cultures, you know, steeped in deep tradition or irrationalism could very well reject these things, but that can't deny the reality that human beings are beings of a particular kind. We live in a particular kind of universe, and a particular kind of action is prescribed to us based on our natures.
Right.
You can't deny that reasoning beings must reason to live, and that in order to live and to reason, we have to be free from compulsion. And so we set up societies, if we're going to live in societies, because it is beneficial to us to live in societies, where that principle becomes a primary, where we have whatever apparatus we set up is about the mitigation of violence and force, and specifications for its use being very clear to everybody.
Would you say I so love everything we're talking about? And by the way, we're going to have to wrap it up in a couple of minutes. And I love conversations where you hit record, and you're like, what? Are you kidding me? We're almost done. We're barely scratching the surface. As I figured would be the case. I think you said early out, right out of the gate, you know, radical capitalism, something objectivism often misunderstood. Do you feel misunderstood? I mean, to me, you said, you know, so clear, you should be at the front of the class, you know, teaching this stuff. It seems to me, maybe you already are, I don't know, but tell me about that, that frustration that you must feel as you're taking this, the American Capitalist Party, I guess, into the 21st century.
I mean, our political world has gone from a world in which the Federalist Papers were published in newspapers, and the average citizen would read the arguments for and against the Constitution and make up their minds, to one in which entire political philosophies are encapsulated in three words.
Right.
So when you have a philosophical or ethical ideal that requires validation on a somewhat detailed manner, it's fairly hard to go up against the bromide spouting, cliche riddled politicians of the day who spout these amorphous phrases out in the world that mean everything to everyone, and like hope and change, or, you know, make America great again. All these nonsensical phrases, they really have no meaning whatsoever. They're not attached to anything. Well, it's to get up there and talk about individual rights. You're it's a bit of an uphill battle,
right?
And so, in addition to the dumbing down of the political world, you also have a society that is more or less beginning to accept elements of statism as a given. In America, this was a relatively recent development. America was unique in its development, and so was able to sort of avoid the pitfalls of Europe and the rest of the world for quite a while. But now, you know, we're sort of presuming the truth of political institutions and ideas. How am I going to say that? We're sort of making the same presumptions. That's what I want to say,
right,
about the political institutions that they've been doing in Europe for years and years and years and years. So it's definitely an uphill battle when people presume the state has to be this, and you say, well, no, actually, it should be this, and you don't have. You can't say it in three words.
Well, and Mark, where do you? Oh man, it makes me crazy that we're having to wrap up here in a few minutes. But where do you have those conversations? Right. I mean, if we're, and listen, I'm not anti Twitter, I'm not anti Instagram or social media, but if this is where we're getting our news largely, and we're not going deep, and we're not going for substance, or maybe we are. Maybe there's an argument for, I look at some of the. I have an 11 and a 13 year old. I look at some of the questions they're asking, and some of the things they've already been introduced to at a really young age. I go, wow, you're way farther ahead than I was, you know. And so, anyway, I just wonder what are your thoughts about that? Like, is it the university? Is it the Rotary Club? Or is it the movie theater? Is that where people are getting some of this?
Oh, I mean, I think the university is a huge culprit in the disintegration of the American mind. But culture participates in it. Well, culture is sort of, you know, downstream from the everything's downstream from the university. So it's all affected by this nihilistic. Sort of postmodernist nonsense. It's disintegrating nonsense that's going on in the universities. But I think social media can be a sort of antidote to it,
right?
Because it's there's so many bad things about it, but there's also so many good things about it, and that it gives these alternative voices actually a microphone and a platform. And for me, as crappy as Twitter can be. You know, the how many characters you have, 200 characters,
yeah,
or whatever it is now, whatever that limit is, forces you to a sort of unit economy that I like. If I can crunch my ideas into greater and greater, sparer words that say more, then I know I'm benefiting my cause somewhere down the line.
Yeah, no, that's cool, and maybe that's where we should end it. That to me comes back again. And tell me if I'm wrong on this, but it sounds like you're just being radically consistent again.
There you go.
Yeah, listen, I wow, what a great time. We've been talking with Mark Pellegrino. He's the co-founder of the American Capitalist Party. You can check them out online for more information there. Film and TV actor of great note. You've got to check him out. Mark, we barely talked about your career as an actor, and I apologize for that. Maybe we can do a part two down the road. Can you tell me one? Okay, let's end here. How's this? One of the roles or two of the roles that you would say that kind of that narratively have supported the work that you're going to do, as a radical capitalist, you're trying to change hearts and minds. is that a crazy question?
I mean, because I don't think I've ever acted in a part that resembles me,
right,
or my beliefs. I can only attack that from a certain perspective, which is what parts have enabled me to have an audience or a platform to be able to talk about these ideas. I would say, you know, my sci-fi work with Supernatural and Lost and Being Human. And then now 13 Reasons Why has, which I've been in for 3 years, has enabled me to open up another platform with respect to suicide and suicide awareness. And so that, I think, has enabled enough of a fan base to get the word out.
Yeah, very, very practical. I heard somewhere, I think I read somewhere online that you didn't actually audition for the role for Lucifer for Supernatural. Is that true?
That is true.
So that's a little troubling to me, Mark.
It's troubling to me. Yeah. But hey, I look at Lucifer differently than most people do. So yeah, maybe not so troubling.
I bet you do. And that is, wow, that just, you opened another door for me to walk down into a new hallway. I have had such a wonderful time with you here today. Thanks again, Mark, for a great conversation. Mark Pellegrino, film and TV actor. He's the co-founder of the American Capitalist Party, here with us today on Face to Face. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, man. It's great. You're great.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.